From MyDomain.com, this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today's guest is a true pioneer and someone who has built an incredible female-focused and led company. Her name is Rena Pachansky, and she is the co-founder and CEO of Digital Brand Architects, aka DBA. You might not have heard of DBA, but your favorite influencers definitely have, because it's the first influencer management company and talent agency. Their roster includes over 150 of the most powerful social media influencers, including Ami Song, Chriselle Lim, Gabby Gregg. You'd assume that Rena probably came up in the talent agency world to lead such an extraordinary company. She actually spent the first half of her career as a publicist in technology, fashion, and corporate PR. Here's Rena Pachansky talking about her career pivots on Second Life. So for the last decade or so, you've been this mega huge pioneer with your company DBA and started representing influencers and tastemakers long before anyone knew what to do with them or took them seriously, which makes you a stone cold genius in my book. So while I could talk to you about DBA literally all day, let's start by talking about what you did before you created your genius company. Tell me about how you started your career.
So I dropped out of college my sophomore year. I went to BU and I came home and my parents were like, you're going to have to get a job. And my dad was in PR and worked at Edelman PR. And so I started to intern and then ultimately work full time for Edelman in the division that they called high technology at the time. And they had Microsoft and Adobe and Oracle and all these companies. And I started
Did you care about that at 19?
I didn't even know what they were. I had no idea. I remember sitting in meetings. Now I remember it. But I was in meetings with Larry Ellison.
No.
And
what?
Yeah, no, just sitting in a meeting with him. And I had no concept of what was going on.
Cared not at all.
Not in the least. Not in the least. I was just excited that I was getting a paycheck and I could go shopping.
Yeah.
And that was
That's real.
Larry Ellison. Who was that? And I worked on the Microsoft account, and they were launching products. And so I launched a product with Microsoft and toured CompUSA parking lots.
Chic.
In satin jackets.
Ooh.
In a bus called the Microsoft Explorasora bus.
Wow.
And I gave tours to reporters in basically across the country in CompUSA parking lots. And that was like my entree into PR. And so after I'd been at Edelman in like, really an insanely exciting time in tech. This is forever ago. It wasn't even called tech at the time. I was like, this is boring. And like, I want to do fashion, stupidly. And I went and applied for a job at Neiman Marcus in White Plains. And I became the PR coordinator for the Neiman Marcus in White Plains.
What made you decide to why that? Why that job?
I mean, there was this new mall that had just opened called, what's it called? It's called the Westchester. And it was this like massive new mall. It was just this big deal. And I was like, oh my God, Neiman Marcus, I'm going to go work there. And so I got this job as the PR coordinator, which was the assistant to the PR director. And essentially Neiman Marcus at the time, and I think still to this day, are one of those stores that really like doubles down on their consumer events and their customer events and in-circle events and trunk shows. And this was a very different time too in terms of retail and fashion. And so there was always something going on for their customers. And I became like, I was 20 years old, and I remember shopping at Nordstrom because you got this amazing discount, and I was wearing like St. John suits. Like I was in like full St. John, because that's what all the other women who were like 60 years old who had spent a lifetime working at Neiman's, like that's what they wore. So that's what I started to wear too.
At 20.
At 20. And I looked ridiculous, but I was so excited. I just was like, me in my St. John suit would like stomp around the store, like arranging Escada trunk shows and like Stanley Marcus personal appearances and in-circle events. And I thought it was the greatest thing in the world.
So did you know what you were doing? I mean, you'd had a smidge of experience, but you were pretty green, right?
So green.
Was it just instinct? Did you feel like
it was like just instinct? And it was a lot of event planning. It was a little bit less PR and more event planning. And there was actually one time where a reporter from the New York Times called, and I picked up the phone and decided to go on the record, like, for whatever reason, and, like, talk to her about sales. Like, just like, sure, you know, you always, you think you know everything in your 20s. And I remember giving her a quote that was awful, and then it came out in the paper, and my boss was like, you can't ever do that. You can't talk to press. You have to understand. And, like, that was a big learning moment to sort of do something and really, like, fuck
step
up.
Step in it.
Yeah. And then feel, like, you know, sort of start to understand the ramifications. But from there I went and then had the same, a similar job, but the promoted version of it for a Saks Fifth Avenue in Greenwich. And then I went to work in corporate in New York.
What made you decide to want to switch over to corporate?
Well, they actually recruited me into corporate, which was amazing. I was just such a little, like, go-getter. I was like one of the, I was like, anything you need, I'm there. Like, I don't need to sleep. I'll just do everything. I was so excited about having all these opportunities. And the discount. I was really excited about the discount.
So you came from a place of yes.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Always. And I was so young, too, you know. And I had was sort of like going into these jobs one after the next after the next. So when I went to work for corporate at Saks, I want to say I was like 22 or 23. I was so young.
And at that point, you had an actual resume as opposed to probably other people who were just getting out of college
right.
and, you know, had maybe been waitressing or whatever.
Exactly.
And you actually had this body of work and skill set already.
Right. And so it was like, oh, you opened a store. Like, you understand what that's like. And also, people just want to know, like, you can hustle and work hard.
Right. But was it hard working with other people who were older at that point, or did you, was that never an issue for you? Did they look at you like, what's this whippersnapper doing here? Or were they cool?
It was like, I think what was hard was more that I felt really insecure. Like, I remember someone saying, oh, go have a conversation with so-and-so, like a DMM of like cosmetics. And I was like, I would agonize and like be up at night worrying about what that meeting was going to be like, or if I was going to sound smart enough, or if I was going to seem too young. I think I worried about it a lot more than people in the room worried about it. So that was like a hindrance. And I think something, it's like you always think something's about you and it's never about you.
So you're in corporate. How is that different?
It was real. I worked for a woman.
Is this in New York?
This is in New York, yeah.
So,
I still remember the address. It was 12 East 49th Street. It was right across from the Saks store. And actually, during the holidays, executives would have to sometimes go and work in the store. And some people would have, like, you'd have to have, like, escalator duty. And you would, like, stand by the escalators and, like, help. Because there was so much traffic during the holidays. And you would have to, like, help.
Be a
like,
traffic cop.
Yeah, basically be a traffic cop in an escalator.
So you're in the city.
Yeah.
You're working for Saks Corporate. You are aggressively young. What was that like?
It was amazing and petrifying. So it was amazing because there was an incredible, at the time, Rosemary Bravo was the president of Saks, and she was this formidable woman. And Jackie Livedini was the head of communications for Saks, and I worked for her. I reported up into her. She was the head of the whole department. And they were these badass women. And it was great to get to see that. And I was lucky that I had all these amazing women around me. And so that was fun because I felt like I was part of a tribe. And having not graduated college, not done that whole thing.
That's your sorority.
It was sort of like my sorority, but it was fun. It felt like you were part of like a real team.
So what were your responsibilities like?
So I had two different jobs. One was I oversaw the PR for the outside of New York stores. And each of the stores themselves had PR managers. So really it was about like organizing all of the activities in all the stores. So
all of the events and trunk shows
yeah.
and fashion shows and consumer, just all consumer
anything
events.
Anything consumer facing.
At every store that was not in
that
New
was
York
not
City.
In New York. Yeah. I would coordinate with the local store team in terms of, oh, and I mean, these are dated names because this is what it was, but like Badgley Mischka is coming to town for a personal appearance and, you know, DVF is like reinventing the wrap dress again. And so here's the press release for it. And here's the media strategy. And it was just helping each of these stores sort of roll that out. And then I also did it on the other side of the spectrum for events as well.
Okay. So that's dealing with a lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
So it's the store. It's all of the people in the store. And then it's all of these vendors, all of these brands, and what each brand wants to communicate and how they feel and like protecting that relationship too, because you obviously want them to be happy. Again, I got to ask, how did you know how to do all this?
So there's a lot of things I don't do well. So like I know what I don't do well.
Like what?
I'm not great with details.
Interesting.
I'm bad with details.
That is not what I was going to expect to hear out of your mouth.
I'm great with big picture. And I'm great. My intuition, I always feel like, is my gift. So for me, I always felt like I was good at sort of being a part of a conversation or walking into a room and kind of being able to read the room and understand like what was going on. So that was always what I leaned into the most. But I'm bad when it comes to details.
So how would you get all of this stuff done then? Raina, that's crazy.
A lot of it was winging it. It really was. It was like faking. It's so much of faking it. I feel like at the end of the day, if your intentions are good and like you want to do a good job and you understand what the end result needs to be, sometimes you can fudge a little bit on the details. Not always, but that was kind of how I did it when I was younger.
Well, part of that is, like, I always talk about how I think that being resourceful and being able to problem solve are the two most important things. Like, I don't care what your background is. If you can show me and demonstrate that you are able to be resourceful and that you are able to think on your feet and problem solve, or at least present options or solutions to problems, even if we don't end up going with it, that's some of the most important stuff ever. And that's not always stuff that you can necessarily teach. A lot of that has to do with attitude, and a lot of that comes from hustle, which you obviously had in spades.
Well, it's 100% right. It's like, what kind of person do you want in the room with you? You want someone who you're just going to be like, all right, let's figure this out.
Yes. And it's like, it's not always that hard.
No.
You just got to figure it out.
Yeah. And a lot of it comes down to communication, too. It's like, how do you communicate? And I think also the thing that I learned early on was, like, consistency is key. So I always tried to just make sure that I was as consistent as possible.
True. Because people got to know what to expect also.
Right.
Okay. So you're doing all this at Saks Corporate. What happens next?
So for whatever reason, I don't know why, but I was like, I want to try entertainment. Like, I want to do something. I have no idea why. I really can't remember, actually. But
well, because so you're a youth.
So I was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do that next. So I left Saks and went to work for this woman, Peggy Siegel, who was like, I mean, she's still around. She's still amazing. But she was like the queen of movie premieres and screenings and Academy screenings, which is like when Academy members, before screeners were as much of a thing, they would go out and like see the film and you would like court their vote for the Oscars. And I worked for her. And she, in my interview, she asked me three things. She said, how old are you? Do you have a boyfriend? And do you know anyone at Page Six? And
what were the correct answers for that?
So me being me, because I had also just come from this really corporate background, I was like, it's illegal to ask me my age.
I'm sure she probably liked that. She was standing your ground.
She's like, I'll tell you my age. I'm 50. I don't care. And I was like, okay. I mean, she was crazy. And so I worked for her.
Wait, why did she want to know those things?
How old was I? Am I going to like burn out? Did I have a boyfriend? Is that going to get in the way? Like, am I going to just be like, okay, my boyfriend come to the screening? And who do I know at Page Six? Because at the time, everything revolved around a Page Six item. It was like, do you know Richard Johnson? So I didn't have a boyfriend. I didn't know anyone at Page Six, and I accused her of being discriminatory because she asked me my age, racers, and ages. But I got the job, and it was incredible. It was absolutely amazing. On like day two, she put me on the phone with like the head of a studio for a screening I had staffed the night before, and he was like grilling me about what people thought, and I hadn't even stayed the whole time, and I like made it up, and.
You really believe in winging it. I love that.
I was like, oh, yeah, they loved it. But it was amazing. I mean, she was, talk about tenacity. You couldn't say no to her. There was just no such thing. And that was incredible. Again, like I was lucky. I was so fortunate to have these just like amazing, really, really strong women. And so I did that for a few years. And then.
What kind of stuff were you doing? Just organizing?
It was all around screenings and movies. So like when the next sort of iteration of Star Wars movies, like Star Wars Episode One came out.
Like the Natalie Portman
ones? The Natalie Portman
ones?
One, okay, yeah.
Got it.
Like really large scale events. And then there would be things like I remember doing all these Academy screenings for Magnolia and Rushmore.
Yeah. One of my favorite movies.
Oh my God,
of all time.
One of my favorites. I remember when we were doing screenings for Magnolia, and I remember being at the screening room, and Paul Thomas Anderson came in with the print himself. It was like up until the last second he was editing. It was one of the most amazing. Like now I'm like, oh my God, that's unbelievable. I don't think at the time I registered how incredible it was.
Okay, so you were doing super cool things like this for several years.
Yeah.
And then what?
Then I went to Harrison and Schriftman, Laura Schriftman, another amazing woman, wooed me away from Peggy. And I went to do, so there was this like genre back in the day of press. It was called event press, like fast-breaking press. And essentially what it meant was that New York was just every night there was a different brand launching something. There was a different movie premiere. There was something going on. And at the time, the sort of most important press was Page Six or Rush and Malloy or Intelligencer and New York Magazine. Like all of these, like those were the outlets that mattered. If you got a photo in People's Style Watch, like there was 10 outlets. And so that was my specialty, was like pitching those outlets. Mitchell Fink. So that's what I did for Harrison Schriftman. I like led this department of like what they called the vent press. And it was all about those outlets.
Did you know those outlets? Did you have connections there?
I did a little bit from Peggy, but also it's very much, and I say this all the time with the team at DBA, the people, and you, I mean, you know this because these people are still your closest friends, like the people who you sort of grow up with in your career are the people that are going to stay with you forever. Like you all do this together. You're all like soldiers together, and then you're all sort of like mid-level together, and then you all become like leaders together. And it's so important to like cultivate those relationships. So a lot of it was just me being out and about and like being friends with people. I mean, there's
relationships.
It's all relationships. There's Deborah Schoeneman, who's an incredible writer, who's my neighbor. I remember I was pitched her at The Observer. She wrote for The Observer. And I still remember the piece. Siegfried and Roy did a movie and we did the premiere for it. And I remember Deb Schoeneman writing this line that was like, there were supposed to be like baby tigers there, but they must have made them disappear because there weren't any. There's something like totally snarky and amazing, but like 20 years later, Deb Schoeneman and I are like still friends.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that sort of stuff.
Well, that's one of the things too that I always try and tell interns or some of the young people coming up in our company is that A, you have to think about the fact that this group of people, even if they end up at different companies or different things, like you're going to keep running into them for the rest of your career for the most part, unless mm-hmm. they completely leave the industry, and not everyone does. So it don't burn bridges. Everyone talks. Everyone knows each other.
Everyone knows
and you
everyone.
You think it's this big industry, but it's not. Like we all know each other. And so it's important to at least like just keep it professional.
Yeah. It's one of the most important things I think that you can learn is that everything that you do in some way, shape, or form will come back to you, better or for worse.
I almost burned a bridge once upon a time ago, back in the day, and I did not. And I'm really glad about it because she and I are still friends. But I was just having one of those like flaming hot, like I'm going to tell you off Real Housewives mm-hmm. moment. And I didn't, and I'm glad about it. But anyway, enough about me and my anger issues. So you're doing this event news?
Press.
Got it. And then what happened?
So then I get recruited as a headhunter. I get recruited away to go to AOL. And this was right after the AOL Time Warner merger. And they
back
were
to tech, man.
Back to tech, I know. And they were all they were looking for someone like me who was just a little bit more like of a New Yorker and had just more of like a connection to New York press.
Smart, cool, and connected.
I mean, like I said, winging it the whole time. So I remember having an interview and the woman who interviewed me was based in New York and she said, oh, well, you know, you'll spend some time in Dulles. And I literally like thought that she mispronounced Dallas and she was talking about Dulles, Virginia, which was of course AOL's headquarters. And I thought she mispronounced Dallas. And so I ended up commuted. So they had this like commuter plane that left out of Teterboro, New Jersey. And once a week I would have to fly to Dulles, Virginia, and spend the day at AOL headquarters. You can imagine, like, on the heels of working for Saks and Peggy Siegel and Laura Schriftman and, like, all these, like, super scrappy New York firms, I was, like, on the AOL campus, and I was a fish out of water. Major fish out of water.
Not a fit.
Not a fit. That's the other thing, too. I think it's important to be able to sort of say, like, it's okay if something doesn't work. And I was just not, we just didn't speak the same language. And so I did it for a year and I really tried to like learn and take something from it. But when another headhunter called me saying that Coach was looking for a head of communications, I was like, where do I sign? And so I interviewed for 6 months with Coach.
Good God.
Yeah. I was the first person and the last person. But they interviewed, I mean, it was a massive process, which is very Coach. They're the most sort of thorough and like meticulous company.
How many interviews? I mean, was it like a series of interviews
or
did it just take forever? Or
series
both?
Of interviews took forever and the series of interviews and meeting people multiple times. So
because they wanted it to be a culture fit, too, yeah. I'm assuming.
Yes, very much. And Reed Krakoff, who was my boss and the creative director at the time, who's, you know, one of the most brilliant people I think I'll ever meet or know.
I miss his line.
Oh, I know. I do, too. So it was so good.
True. But was he amazing to work with?
The most amazing. Like, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't reference something that he taught me.
So you were leading communications there?
Yep, for almost 8 years.
And what did – how was that different from previous fashion communications and PR jobs? Like, was it – I mean, you had this great events background. You knew all of the right people. But, like, you're looking for different press than Richard Johnson and Page Six.
Yeah. So it's funny because when I interviewed – when you were in press back in the day, and to some extent, I guess, still today, it was about, like, who, you know, what are your editor connections? Who do you know? And I had never worked with accessories editors before, ever. It just wasn't my background.
And they are a very specific bunch.
Very specific.
And at that
bunch.
Point in time, too, also, like, career jobs, like, where people wouldn't leave a magazine for 20 years.
And I didn't know any of them. And so I was super stressed about that because I was like, but I don't know any accessories editors. And they're like, that's okay because we want you to be doing like bigger, it's time, we want Coach to be bigger, we want to be doing bigger things and accessories editors, like we know them, like we're Coach, of course we have those relationships. So I was like really careful, I was so like nervous about cultivating my accessories editors relationships. But really at that point, when I joined Coach, they were 500 million and when I left, they were 3.2 billion. And it was the real sort of start. I was lucky to be there at a time with the most amazing team where it was like really, really turning into like a global brand. So what was different about that was I was also head access and was in the room for so many different conversations. I mean,
like
I learned about
strategy conversations
and merchandising conversations and product development conversations. I learned a lot about business. So that role for me was where I really, really started to delve a little bit deeper into like the business side of my brain and starting to understand numbers and retail and
data.
Consumers and data and all of that. So that was why I was able to like, I mean, I was there for almost 8 years and because I was just constantly learning.
So after having this established, respected, exciting, rewarding, rich career in PR, what made you decide to say, you know what, I'm going to go join a startup.
Right.
I'm going to start a startup. Just screw it to all that. I was comfortable and known and safe, and I'm just going to take this ginormous leap and start a company in an area that, let's be frank, we started covering real girls, influencers, bloggers, social media mavens very early on. We were considered weirdos for doing that, but you saw the potential.
So funny, I remember being at Coach and there was like you guys and like four other places. While I was at Coach, we were doing things with, at the time, it was just the category, it was called fashion bloggers. So we were working with a lot of bloggers and I became friendly with them and it just became like a process of, they would ask me for advice and, oh, well, this brand wants to work with me or what do you think about this kind of content? And it was really organic. And at the time, I was burnt out. Like at that point, I had been, like I said, I moved when I was 19 into the city to do this. So I was kind of tired and I felt like I wanted something, like literally a second act. I was like, what's my next thing going to be? I don't know how much longer I have like this exact thing in me, left in me. And so it was just kind of like, let's go for it. There were two other founders of DBA who have both gone on to do other things. But at the time, it was just kind of like, all right, let's just like do this. And
so what was the game plan? You're like, we're going to be a talent agency and then grow it into X, Y, and Z? Or did you think we're just going to rep these girls and what? Like, what was your right. internal business
so
plan?
What's funny is, like, in my mind, I never thought of it as talent management as much as I thought of it. I just, like, saw them as brands. For some reason in my mind, I just was like, they're brands. Because that had always been my background, was sort of in some version of brands, whether it was, like, movies or retail or, you know, like, launching things at Harrison and Trifman. Whatever it was always rooted in, like, a brand.
Like Escada Trunk Show.
Right, Escada Trunk Show. Like, something, it was always, like, there was always a brand and a product attached to it. And I always felt like that's what talent sort of represented for me. And, like, that was the sort of evolution of it. But it was talent management. It was, these people are going to be, this is real talent in the same way that, like, actors are, or directors or painters or whatever that looks like. These are people who are creating something and therefore need some sort of representation themselves as artists, because they are.
But they're also, and the thing that I've always enjoyed about them, and I think the world took a little bit of time to cotton to, but they're also entrepreneurs.
Absolutely. And they were female entrepreneurs. I mean, that was what was really exciting too, is that it was watching women sort of, like, changing the landscape of something. And it was like, this is really cool, because I grew up and admired traditional media and traditional publications, and I still do, and think that they're essential. But it was also watching someone who admired that and taking it, and, like, what's their take on it? What's their version of that? And that was really interesting to see.
And it's interesting, too, because it's not like – like, the boyfriend is the photographer, maybe, and then he gets fired in a breakup, but the girl stays the same, where it's, like, the woman who is doing the 360 on strategy, and she's art directing, and she's styling herself, and to be these really 360 visionaries and people who under brand creators, mm-hmm. that's super exciting. I don't know why the world was so weird about them in the beginning. Yeah. Fashion snobby, whatevs.
Yeah, I mean, you know.
You can't sit with us.
You can't sit with us.
So anyway, so you side with your fellow co-founders mm-hmm. to start this company. And what was your value proposition that you would take out? And, like, who were some of the first people you started working with?
So, oh my God, early days. It was like Kelly Fromell, mm-hmm. Glamour Eye. Emily Schumann was early days, but she wasn't first. Carla.
Yeah.
Carla's Closet. I think that there were, like, 10 people right away. And it was just like, what do you guys want to do? Like, what's your vision? And where do you see yourself? And how can we help you get there? And I think in the beginning it was, we were, you know, of course we were winging it. It was just like, we believe in you.
There we go
right,
again.
There we go again, right. But it was, I don't think we knew 100%. Because, like, we hadn't been, I mean.
It was uncharted territory.
Totally uncharted territory. I mean, again, Instagram didn't exist. So all we were talking about, too, were blogs. And so it was like, all sort of developing. It was all happening at the same time. So, like, while we were figuring out sort of what we were going to do and how we were going to add value, I think our talent was also figuring out, like, what they wanted. So we sort of grew up together. And I think, and I've said this before, and I think it's true, like, we also got to make, everybody did at the time, got to make mistakes while people weren't watching.
One of the greatest things about starting Who What Wear in 2006,
yep.
No one was watching.
Right. So you could do it. You could just figure it out. Like, if now there's so many eyeballs, and the minute you do anything, it's like, what are you doing? That's, you know, it's terrible. Why would you do that?
Angry comments.
I mean, so we made a lot of mistakes, which was great. I mean, you have to allow yourself you have to allow yourself to make mistakes.
Like, what kind of mistakes?
We had this technology that we thought we were developing at one point, and, like, I was like, what are we talking about? Like, and we spent, like, a year. We talked about this technology that we were developing, and it was so absurd. Like, as if we were – I mean, we had just started this company, and we also were, like, tech developers. You know, it's like you try everything, and you yeah. think you can do everything. So it was a lot of, like, you'd see a shiny object – and be like, okay, that's what we should do too.
Well, it's also the industry thing will happen. And then do you remember when flash sales were a thing?
Oh my God, of course.
Post-recession.
Right.
And then for a moment, everyone was like, you know, I remember even our board was asking us, like, why aren't you getting into this? And we're like, that's not what we do. Like, it just seems cannibalistic with our actual advertisers. And also, we're good at content. We're not good at product fulfillment and shipping and there was a moment where we felt like we saw all of our competitors getting into it. We got nervous. We thought, like, are we not essentially doing the equivalent of, like, not investing in Apple?
Right.
like, is everyone going to take off and we're just going to be these sad little people left behind? And the answer was no, we were right. You got to stick to your guns. But I also feel like there's something, there's real value. We've thrown a million things and tried a million things that have not worked. And then you learn from it. You're like, no, that's not really what our forte is. Or it helps you then hone what is your forte.
Right. And there's that period. And I think this is part of being any sort of entrepreneur or just in any career where you have to sort of figure out like what your skill set is. And there are things that are going to be like in the realm of that, which are okay. And then there are things that are just so left of center that it's like, I need to stay away from that. I mean, we, our mantra at DBA is, where do I add value? To be in the room, you have to add value. And I think that that's a big thing, is sort of figuring out what your value is. And it's okay if you don't have a certain skill set. I mean, but it's also better to know exactly, like, what it is.
Do you like being CEO?
It depends on the day. Most days I do. Most days I really love it. It can be it can be a little lonely sometimes. It's nice sometimes when you can, like, just kind of talk to someone and just say, I had a really lousy day and this is why. And you have those days. Like, you have lousy days. You have amazing days. I mean, I went to a conference last year, and the one thing that I took from it that was, like, I think to myself all the time is one of the CEOs said, you're going to have the highest highs and the lowest lows, and they're going to happen in the same hour. And you, like, have to be prepared for that. And I think what I love about it still is how much I still love what I do. Like, I get so excited still, like, when a client does something that they're so passionate about, or when I can, like, help secure something for them, or just, like, help them with a strategy. So I still love what I do so much. The CEO aspect of it, which sometimes is, like, the more business side of it, that can be a little taxing sometimes.
You know, Catherine is our CEO, but as a co-founder, I also sometimes feel that moment of, you know, I feel lucky that she and I have each other, that we can talk to each other, because in our office, we have the most amazing team. But I also have to remember, like, they're not my friends.
Yeah.
They are amazing colleagues, and we do have personal bonds, but there's also, for them, I have to have a certain amount of distance because that's appropriate. And the problem is then it feels lonely. Like, there are times when, like, I leave our office party before I want to leave our office party, because I know that the office party gets better after the bosses or the founders leave. Like, you got to give – and that sucks, because I love a party. I want to stay the whole time. But I know that there are certain things that, like, to be respectful of the team. So I feel you on that.
Well, and also, I don't know if you feel this way, but there are also times when I'm like, oh, I'm like 20. Like,
I don't know the answer.
I don't know the answer. Like, I'm not – when did I become the person who has to have the answer? You know, and that's – but then there are other times when I walk in the room and I'm like, no, I'm definitive. So, you know, that's just real, I think.
Yeah. So what skills do you use on a day-to-day basis that you honed in all of your years of working in PR?
I mean
– all of them?
I mean, listen, on any given day, I'm still pitching something. I mean, whether I'm pitching DBA the company, or I'm pitching a potential new client that they should sign with us, or I'm just, like, trying to convince one of our clients that, like, this is the best path. So I feel like I'm constantly in a place where I am, again, I'm sort of, like, honing in on my intuition and my ability to, like, try to be passionate and convince someone of something.
So a lot of the wonderful listeners of this podcast work in PR, as they have let me know. What advice would you give someone who works in PR and wants to transition to a startup, but maybe they're a little bit scared?
So I think if you're a publicist, you have an array of skills that sort of transcend other jobs. I mean, that might be because I was a publicist, so I'm speaking so highly of us. But listen, you have the ability to sell. You have the ability to understand a media landscape. You have to understand a brand. You have to be able to understand what you're pitching. So you understand, like, macro things and micro things. And I think that if you want to transition out of PR into whether it's a startup or just another job entirely, I think you've got to sort of talk about all the various things that you're able to pull together. Because PR requires like a lot of different skills. And I think that's what's most important or most valuable to any employer is someone's ability to be versatile, especially in this day and age when like
everyone's got to be well-rounded.
And you've got to be able to do everything. And I think that publicists sort of have that innately. And also, listen, sometimes you're holding someone's drink at a party and 2 minutes later you're having to talk to like, you know,
The New York Times.
The New York Times. So that, but that's a skill set in and of itself. And I think that that's important to really talk about that level of like, you
know. Being able to toggle in that way. So, crazy question. When you did this leap, were you worried about money?
It was interesting because I was sort of at like the top of my game when I left Coach. So I was in a comfortable position where I had a wonderful salary and
but that's scary to
all
give
up. These things. And it was super scary to give up. But I also felt like I was lucky because I had some savings because I was at a sort of a different place in my career. But then I went and started, you know, you have this company and you make no, just, you don't make money. There's no money. And
no
every
money.
Penny goes back into the company, every penny. And so you're really like living like on nothing. But I felt great about it because I was so excited about what I was doing. So I think that, I mean, listen, you know, it's hard because I also remember being like, well, I could sell that bag if I need to.
Like, I remember looking in my closet doing the same thing. I almost sold my first Gucci bag, which I ended up not. But I was like, it, and my mom asked me about a watch at one point in time that she saw me wearing it. And she thought that I had sold it all of those years ago to make rent at some point in time.
Right. So I think that, you know, it's tough because you want to like, you know, and you want to chase your dream and do that, but you also obviously have to be in a position where you can like afford your rent. And I think that the truth is it's always better to take the leap and to always sort of just say, I'm going to go for it and I'll figure it out. Because I think most of the time you do figure it out.
Here's the other thing. Like when you come from such a solid background and you have a proven track record, worst case scenario, you can find something, you can go back in some way. I mean, not maybe to the exact job, but you have – you're still a viable candidate. And I think sometimes people forget that.
Yeah. And I think, listen, today with the way the economy is, there are so many jobs that you can do now that might not be what you're passionate about, but you can make money doing them and you can be pursuing something else at the same time. So I think it's always a matter of like, I was scared, but I was also like, this is kind of freeing to like just be doing something and not really be thinking about, you know, how much money I'm making, but just be sort of moving
doing
forward.
It for the passion. Yeah. So you're a mom, too, and you have a life outside of work. So my question is this. What tips do you have for being efficient? Because I assume that I feel like being a mom makes you much more efficient because you have so much more on your plate. So what are your efficiency tips?
So I always – I read these, like, whenever any mom is like, this is what I do, and when they're like, you know, I try not to be on my phone when I'm, you know, and I'm always like, well, I'm always on my phone. I mean, I don't like
– like, struggle's real.
It's, you know. I think you have to wake up earlier.
Okay.
I mean, I think that my thing is try to get as much done first thing in the morning because I think we're our most effective. I think that as the day goes on, you just naturally get more exhausted. It's like I have a meeting at 4 o'clock and I'm not nearly as eloquent as I am at like 9 o'clock on a call. And I think that like force yourself to get up earlier and to try and like get more done in the very early hours of the morning. And then it makes the day a little bit easier because there's only so many hours in the day. And the reality is like something's got to give.
So last question. What advice would you give your 19-year-old self?
Save money. No, seriously. I love when people say things like, trust your instincts and like these wonderful things. But the truth is, I honestly would tell myself to save money. Like you don't realize at a young age, 19, 20, I mean, 30, saving money, even
last
just putting,
week.
Like last week, I mean, literally, an accountant once said to me, multiply anything you're about to spend times 7, because that's what it takes away from your retirement down the road. And listen, when you're 19, you're not thinking about retirement, but that's what I would say, honestly, is like, think about saving money. Because again, exactly what you were saying earlier, which is like, how do you pursue your dreams if you don't have savings? And that's hard. But if you're thinking about it that way and thinking about, to some extent, having that you know, having a little bit of financial security is freedom, and it's freeing, and it allows you to do things. And I think that that's, like, so important.
I always think it allows you to make all kinds of different life choices, different relationship choices, different job choices, different friend choices. Like, when you have freedom, financial freedom is really that, along with reproductive freedom, is, you know, the sort of the key to living your best life.
Yeah. And there's something really empowering about it as well, like knowing that you've saved money and that you're making decisions. And when you go
No one can take that away from you.
No one.
That was DBA co-founder and CEO Raina Pachansky. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode of Second Life. For more interviews with inspiring women like Raina, head on over to mydomain.com, where we have so many more stories for you to peruse. As always, I'd love to know who you'd like to hear on this show. So send your request to secondlife@mydomain.com, or you can just DM me on Instagram @HillaryKerr. If you liked today's show, and I truly hope that you did, please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, spread the word. I love it when I see you tagging the show. That makes me super happy. Just saying. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you're listening to Second Life by mydomain.com.